three cases.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome
to
this exciting panel and presentation on water. I'd like to introduce the moderator of the panel, David Aldridge, who is a senior partner at Booz Allen, and Booz Allen is a sponsor of this track, so we're delighted to have him here. David, it's all yours.
Thank you very much. Got it?
All right.
Well, welcome. John mentioned, I work for Booz Allen Hamilton, and my background is primarily in the energy, environmental, and natural resource management area. So it's a real pleasure for me to be here with some very distinguished panel members today. The subject, as he said, is water. Usable clean water, or the lack of it, is clearly an issue that has major impact on many elements of our global society today, and that impact is likely to increase in the future. Over a billion people on the globe today do not have access to safe drinking water. The Copenhagen Consensus estimated that nearly half of the people that live in developing countries at any given point in time suffer from one or more waterborne illnesses. On an overall country basis, clearly we have some countries that are awash in abundant water supplies, but others face varying degrees of scarcity due to severe climate or inadequate water management practices, water resource management practices, and infrastructure, and also increasing demand through population and economic growth. On a more and more frequent basis, we're hearing about countries, India being an example, that are challenging, are confronting major corporations on their use of water for production of local products. Even here in the United States, continued development in the Southwest strains water resources in that region of our country. And some have suggested that water may eventually become the new oil, perhaps an even more important currency in the future because of its importance to sustaining life, and one that could lead to confrontation and potentially even war. Now, awareness of the water scarcity problem is certainly not new, but recognition of its importance and urgency of dealing with it has increased in recent years, as has an appreciation that answers to the problem or solutions to the problem are not simple. The problem is increasingly seen as complex, interdependent, and most frequently, individual countries or governments or other decision entities don't have all the control that they need to solve the issue. Solutions to the problem do require concerted and coordinated efforts across multiple stakeholder communities. Those stakeholder communities are multidisciplinary in nature. There is clearly, for solution to the water problem, the need for, the requirement for existence of at least minimally acceptable, minimally functioning governance bodies to assure adequate stability in a country or region. And of course, climate change, the issue that we're hearing a lot about in various sessions here, has the potential to further complicate the challenge. changes in precipitation patterns clearly can lead to increased areas of drought, flooding, and potentially may render certain water infrastructure obsolete. So what are the implications of all these problems? How can governments and commercial entities and institutions work together to better solve them? And what levers and strategies need to be applied in, to do so? Those are some of the issues that we want to discuss this morning. To do that, we have a very distinguished panel, four individuals that I'll introduce. To my immediate right is John Holdren. John is, he wears a lot of hats right now, but John is currently director of the Woods Hole Research Center. He is the Teresa and John Hines Professor of Environmental Policy and director of the Program on Science, Technology, and Public Policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. He also is a professor of environmental science within Harvard University proper. Prior to those roles, he co-founded and led the Multidisciplinary Energy and Resources Graduate Program at the University of California in Berkeley. Throughout his career, he has worked extensively on and made major contributions in the areas of climate change, energy technology evaluation, energy policy, as well as the threat of nuclear weapons and materials nonproliferation or proliferation. He's a member of both the National Academy of Sciences, National Academy of Engineering, and he's currently president of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. To his right is Rosina Bierbaum. Rosina is a biologist and ecologist by training. She's currently dean of the School of Natural Resources and Environment at the University of Michigan. And prior to that, she was associate director of the Office of Science and Technology Policy under President Clinton, where she had a very significant role in climate change, environmental, and energy technology arenas. And she led several very influential U.S. Delegations in the climate change arena. Next to her is Harriet Babbitt, prefers Hattie Babbitt. Hattie's an attorney by training. She served as the deputy administrator of AID from 1997 to 2001, where she was actively involved in the full range of activities that that organization pursues. And prior to that, she was the U.S. ambassador to the Organization for American States, or of American States. Very distinguished activities from her in a variety of areas, including a very recent co-chairing that she did with Bill Riley of a forum on clean water and sanitation that was held a year and a quarter ago, sponsored by the Aspen Institute, that provided inputs to the fourth World Water Forum that took place this past spring in Mexico City. And then finally, to her right, is M. Sanjian, goes by Sanjin. And Sanjin is one of three lead scientists at the Nature Conservancy. He's also on their executive leadership team. Prior to being there, he was a consultant to the World Bank, the Global Environmental Facility, and several other NGOs. So we have a very distinguished panel. What we're going to do is we'll have some short initial comments from each of them. I'll probably use my prerogative after that to ask a few questions, and then we'll open it up to questions and comments from all of you. Just for those of you who don't know, we have microphones on either side of the auditorium near the front. And so please use those when we get to that point of our of the session. John, would you like to kick us off?
Yes, thank you very much, Dave. My task is to introduce these issues and, in a sense, set up the subsequent comments of my colleagues. I have 7 minutes to do that. If you'll forgive the metaphor, this is going to be a little bit like a drink from a fire hose. And that's one of the reasons I like to use visual aids. If I go too fast, anybody who's interested, I'd be happy to email the presentation to you subsequently. The United Nations did an evaluation of the major environmental problems facing the world at the turn of the century, and they concluded that the lack of water is one of the two most worrying problems in that domain, and they concluded that the other one was global warming, and as Dave already pointed out, those two problems are in fact not separate problems but are tightly interconnected, and we'll hear more about that. Let me just start with a sort of a listing of the major water issues, the major problems that afflict the water arena. One, of course, is simply rising demands on limited freshwater resources coming from demographic change, both growth and redistribution of population, and also from rising affluence, which influences irrigation demands for water, industrial demands for water, as well as domestic demands. Second and related problem is political tensions and conflicts over water allocation, both within countries, we know about that in the American West, and among countries in the context of international river basins. Third is widespread and indeed in many respects growing contamination of water, contamination by bacteria, by viruses, and also, of course, chemical pollutants of a wide variety of kinds. Fourth is the wide array of environmental impacts of water withdrawals for human use, withdrawals from both surface and groundwater, and environmental impacts of water projects. A fifth is the impacts of global climate change on the water situation, which has many different dimensions, and Rosina Bierbaum will talk about those in more detail. And finally is the changing landscape of public and private water management, valuation, and marketing, and how that fits with this whole array of problems. I tell my students that the...
Mine got turned back on.
I got unplugged, I guess.
Not a commentary.
I'm going to shout for a moment while they're redoing this. I tell my students that the numbers aren't everything, but they are something, that it helps to have some sense of the magnitudes of things. And I'll give you a few key numbers about global water, both in terms of stocks and in terms of flows. There's a lot of water out there in the oceans, 1.4 billion cubic kilometers. Unfortunately, it's very salty. There's 30 million cubic kilometers locked up in ice. We may get access to more of that as a result of climate change, but that's not a desirable approach. About a third as much as in the ice is in the groundwater. Water in lakes and rivers is a very small fraction of what is in the groundwater. And then you look more interestingly, because water is a renewable resource, you want to look at the flows. The amount of water that falls on the land in a year is 120,000 cubic kilometers. 70,000 of that evaporates. That leaves 50,000 for river runoff and groundwater recharge. But the amount that's actually available, the part that is not lost to storm runoff or is geographically inaccessible, is only about a quarter of that, about 12,000 cubic kilometers a year. And humans are already withdrawing something approaching 40% of the renewable flow that's available. Humans are withdrawing 5,000 cubic kilometers a year for an array of human uses, which I'll elaborate. Whoops, I went all the way to the end. Didn't want to do that. Excuse me for, apparently I pushed the wrong key here, and I'm going to have to recover the danger of PowerPoint. Okay, that's where we are. And just for comparison, given how much of that water is salty, people are interested in the capacity of desalting technology to make some of that salt water available as fresh. The world desalting capacity today is 13 cubic kilometers per year compared to the human requirement of 5,000. So you can see it is literally a drop in the bucket at this stage, and we'll subsequently see why. Look at water demand in more detail. Again, 5,000 kilometers withdrawn, total cubic kilometers. Most of that, 70% of that goes to agriculture. 20% of it goes to industry. Only 10% is domestic use, and what astonishes most people... did it again. That key there is giving me nightmares. Okay, here we are. So you see that drinking water is only 1% of the 10% of human water uses that goes for domestic purposes. So drinking water, as important as it is to human well-being and survival, is a tiny fraction of human water demands. Bottled water is about a 30th of the drinking water requirement of the planet today, but as we'll see, it's the most expensive share. look at this in per capita terms, global average withdrawals per person, that includes the agricultural and the industrial and the municipal use, is about 800 cubic kilometers, but there's a huge range among countries. Nigeria, 50, Israel, 300, China, 500, Mexico, 800, Italy, 1,000, and the United States up there at the top of the list, 2,000 cubic meters per person per year withdrawn in the United States. U.S. water use has been roughly flat since 1970. It's very high in absolute terms, but it has not been growing. We have been offsetting the effects of rising affluence and population growth through improving the efficiency with which water is used, particularly in agriculture and industry. Looking at the problem of safe drinking water and basic sanitation, talk about the reality. The World Health Organization in the year 2000 estimated that 1.1 billion people lacked access to safe drinking water, 2.4 billion lacked access to sanitation. The UN Millennium Development Goals proposed that we should, by 2015, have cut in half the proportion of people without sustainable access to safe drinking water and basic sanitation. Offered a couple of indicators there for measuring that progress. This is an admirable goal, but even if it's achieved, it is slow progress indeed toward addressing one of the most basic human well-being problems connected with water. If you look at this in terms of contributors to global mortality, this is all contributions to global mortality evaluated by the World Health Organization in 2002 in terms of millions of years of life lost. That is, that's premature deaths times years of lost life expectancy per death. So childhood deaths rank particularly high in this categorization. And the role of unsafe water, you see, is in the middle of the list. It's a quarter of childhood and maternal malnutrition, a third of high blood pressure, cholesterol, overweight, and low physical activity, in the same ballpark with tobacco, indoor smoke, somewhat larger than alcohol. It's a big deal. This is a lot of excess mortality coming from unsafe water. You look at the laundry list of environmental impacts of water withdrawals and water projects, reduced river flows, produce a whole variety of consequences, higher water temperatures, lower dissolved oxygen, degraded habitat, saltwater intrusion, and so on. Dams have their own array of environmental problems, and depletion of groundwater causes subsidence and property damage, causes existing wells to run dry, increases the drilling and pumping costs for new ones. Impacts of climate change I will not really talk about except to show them here on the screen because Rosina Bierbaum is going to talk about that in detail. But there's an immense set of interactions between climate change and the water problems we're already experiencing, and most of those interactions are in the direction of making our water problems worse. Changing landscape of water economics and policy. Fundamental question is whether water is a commodity or a basic human right. The United Nations and a long history of heavy subsidies for water supplies suggest that it's a right, but recent trends in the privatization of water supply suggest it's a commodity, and the supporters of that point of view point out correctly that realistic pricing will reduce waste and non-competitive uses. By non-competitive uses, I mean things like huge amount of agricultural water used in California to grow alfalfa, which would not be grown in California at all if the water was not heavily subsidized. Clearly, I would argue water is both a human right at the basic needs level and a commodity. And the questions are, will we continue, therefore, to subsidize basic needs while letting the market increasingly determine the prices for discretionary uses of water, or will we apply price to everything and end up with, as in so many other areas, the poor priced out of the game? Just a closing slide to show the immense range of costs of water. Costs of water in the United States in 2004 in dollars per cubic meter. A cubic meter, by the way, is 1,000 liters, for those of you who want to turn this into a more familiar term. Western farmers in the United States getting heavily subsidized water pay between 5 and 10 cents per cubic meter. Urban users typically pay between 25 cents and 75 cents. California residences, just as an example, what you pay for tap water in California is 50 cents. That can be compared with bottled water in California in 2003, which was $1,000 per cubic meter. And you may be aware that there is some question as to whether the bottled water is in fact any cleaner or safer than the tap water in modern industrialized societies. Desalted water at the desalination plant is 75 cents to $1.50 per cubic meter, and that doesn't count the cost of transporting it to the users, as mentioned at the bottom. We could easily afford to pay for desalted water for drinking water. We could not afford to pay for desalted water for irrigation of crops, which is, as we've already seen, overwhelmingly the largest use of water by civilization. I will stop there.
Thank you, John. Racina?
And we will try to get...
We'll get mine up. I'm going to use my few minutes on water and climate change, because climate change is clearly going to change the historical rules for water in terms of its quantity, its quality, and its timing. So, for example, all of our water planning models assume that the last 100 years is a good surrogate for the future 100 years, which is, of course, completely wrong. So what will climate change do? The first thing it will do is it will change the temperature. And so we're looking at the left part of that chart. And as the temperature increases, that actually speeds up the water cycle, increases evaporation, but also increases total precipitation, which can come down as rain or snow. And you've seen both blamed on climate change. And we'll also see sea level rise, in part from the melting of mountain glaciers and in part from the thermal expansion of the water. And I would argue that those three changes, temperature, precip, and sea level rise, will change the ideal range where everything will live, whether they be crops or forests or fish. And it will also have some direct and indirect effects on water. So the first panel there is water resource impacts on the right. So yes, we'll have changes in supply, quality, and increased competition for water. But as you look through the rest of the sectors, I've just colored some in the same panels now in red, where you see irrigation and droughts will be issues for crops, waterborne diseases for health, erosive floods, and sea level rise for many socioeconomic impacts. We're already seeing that the hydrological cycle of the planet has speeded up. And here, just for the U.S., I show you by size of green circle, the percentage precip has increased over the last 100 years. So the biggest circles on that map are a 20% increase in water coming as rainfall or precipitation, rain or snow. Some parts are getting drier, depicted by the brown dots. And this all averages out to an 8% increase in rainfall in the U.S. over the last 100 years. We've also seen a change in the date of the last snow on the ground. And this next map shows you the areas in red where snow melt has occurred between 13 and 19 days earlier than it did 50 years ago. So snow melt some 2 weeks earlier in the Pacific Northwest. And as you know, this is very important. The timing of this is very important for summer water supplies, for hydro, for salmon, and for people. We're seeing mountain glaciers worldwide retreat. This is one in Glacier National Park that I painfully climbed. But this is happening all around the world and contributing to sea level rise. For us, the loss of the glaciers in Glacier National Park may be mainly aesthetic, but for many cities in the world, mountain glaciers are the source of city water supplies, very important to consider. We're seeing Greenland, a huge ice sheet, melt at prodigious rates. And here I show you the melting in 1992 and in 2002. If I had a third panel to show you for 2006, you would see that the melting rate has doubled in the last 5 years. And this has actually caught scientists completely by surprise. And we may now need to raise our estimates of sea level increase over the next century to more than a meter, which had been considered the upper limit over the next century. We are also seeing flooding events increase on every continent except Oceania, and this shows you each bar is a decade. The last decade of the 90s cost the world some $300 billion in losses from flood damage, and the climate models project that these kinds of flooding events will continue to increase as climate changes. We're also seeing an increase in droughts worldwide, and this is a picture from the drought of 2003 in India, which clearly shows how different droughts in different parts of the world can affect humans differently. We've been in a drought in many places in the U.S., but I think the impacts are very different than you see in this picture. But the amount of land worldwide that is in severe drought has more than doubled in the last 30 years. And this appears to be most closely related to the increase in temperature that we have seen. And again, an increase in these kinds of drought are expected in the future. So that's what's happened to date. Let's just talk quickly about what the future might portend. So water and climate change, we're going to have to worry about both too much water, too little water, water at the wrong time, and quality of water. So some pictures of potential futures. Here's a map at the end of this century of how heavier downpours may be occurring around the world, where the blue colors are an increase in intensity of rainfall. That is not rain, that's the gentle rains from heaven that Shakespeare talked about, but more of erosive rains that actually cause damage to droughts and flooding and socioeconomic impacts. In terms of sea level rise, this is a map of where wetlands might be at risk and where people might be at risk. Tens of millions of people at risk from sea level rise, whether we stick to the estimates we have today or we actually need to increase them. And the small island states, of course, definitely at risk. Bangladesh alone, with some 13 million people likely to become environmental refugees with a 1 meter sea level rise. That same 1 meter sea level rise would flood this part of Florida, and you can see there's quite a bit of a valuable real estate there. In fact, this amount of sea level rise will take from the U.S. some 7,000 square miles of land. I wonder if anyone tried to take 7,000 miles of land away from the U.S., what we would do, but that's what we expect to be flooded. And if you were able to look from Virginia down through Texas, at coastal cities, there are some 20 of them where surface water supplies may not be high enough to avoid the sea level rise. And so we'll have to think about them and potential saltwater intrusion. And I mentioned that the timing of water is important and that too little water may be of concern. So even though the U.S. has gotten wetter on average and will continue to get wetter on average, these maps show you what the summer growing season soil moisture would look like. So from June to August on the upper panel, in a world where we stop at a doubling of CO2, we're some 35% above today, and we should go through that kind of concentration in the next 30 years or so. Or if we head, as we are now, on a business-as-usual path in the lower panel that'll take us to a quadrupling, the conclusion is that the U.S. during the growing season will have some 30% to 60% decrease in soil moisture, clearly a problem for agricultural crops of all times. Another example of the timing of water is now again the Pacific Northwest. And I showed you in an earlier panel how the snowmelt is occurring 2 weeks earlier. This shows you by the end of the next century, it will be up to 25 to 35 days earlier. So the biggest red dots there represent between 25 days and 35 days, or another month earlier. So now we're talking about a 6 week earlier snowmelt in the Pacific Northwest than 50 years ago. And clearly that will affect, again, salmon, hydro people significantly. I wanted to give you one example of water quality, and this shows you in all these tiny little dots the 747 combined sewer overflow systems in the country, and that's where the sanitary sewerage and the surface runoff combine in a single pipe. But when you have extreme rainfall events, which we expect more of as climate changes, the combined overflow comes back up to the surface, and you mix the two compounds and actually can lead to human health effects. And the Cryptosporidium outbreak in Milwaukee was an example of an extreme rainfall event that brought human sewerage to the water supplies. So we can plan ahead or we can react. Wildlife can clearly only react, but humans can anticipate, and I would suggest that bottom panel, given a meter sea level rise, looks like a rather unsustainable system there. So just to end with a few possibilities that I hope we can come back to in our further discussions, there are many opportunities to think about climate change while we are dealing with our natural systems and infrastructure. Clearly, water use efficiencies, our long-term planning better recognize that the last 100 years is not a good surrogate for the future. Land use planning, we really should not build in flood-prone areas, especially with the consideration of sea level rise. We should be developing riparian buffer zones in flood areas. We should be thinking about flexibility and water transfer capabilities. And we should be planning and managing on watershed scales to think about both quality and quantity of water for the future. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Racina. Hattie?
Thanks very much. Dave has asked if I would take a look at sort of the policy and political implications of the water issue. I'm clearly surrounded by some very fancy scientists, and I'm not going to tread much in their territory. Part of what I'd like to start with is some optimism that I bring to this discussion. It's a little easy to get into these discussions and think the only rational response is to leave the room and drink heavily. That is, drink alcoholic beverages heavily. One of the things that we human beings did in the last century was preserve 10% of our land surface on the Earth. That's an extraordinary amount. Now, our challenge for the 21st century is to take care of and the remaining 90%. The point here is that if we have the collective will and the political will, we can do something. ASPEN has been hard at work in mobilizing all of us here to do something. I was involved in a conserving biodiversity gathering. Jack Riggs puts these things together and brought together great minds and some lesser minds to look at these sets of issues. I bring up conserving biodiversity because the photograph on the front of the book we produced was a photograph of water. Land and water are related, and you cannot look at one without the other. ASPEN again brought us together in 2005 to respond to a request from the folks in Mexico putting on the Fourth World Water Forum to come up with local solutions for a global challenge. That was the title, Local Solutions for a Global Challenge, with a heavy emphasis on what can you do and what can we do, particularly with respect to developing countries. We decided to name our effort the Silent Tsunami. The gathering took place after the tsunami in Southeast Asia. And the reality is that as many people die a month for lack of clean water as died in all of the tsunami in Southeast Asia. And we mobilize as a people, particularly Americans, but everyone around the world mobilizes in response to humanitarian crises. It's a tsunami. It's an earthquake in Turkey. It's an earthquake in Pakistan. What is harder to do is to make us mobilize with respect to a silent tsunami like the one with respect to clean water and basic sanitation. I'm going to repeat two of the numbers that John gave because I think they're fundamental to remember in this, and that is that 1.1 billion people in the world don't have access to clean water, and 2.4 billion people in the world don't have access to basic sanitation. Now, basic sanitation is as important as clean water because of the spread of disease, of course, so they are also interrelated. I think these solutions are interrelated, and I thought the group that ASPEN gathered for the Water Forum was a particularly good group. It included all the water buffaloes, the guys who know all about integrated water resource management and environmental leaders, and they were necessary and important to the process. But it wasn't just the water buffaloes. It was people from the administration. It was people from the Hill. And it was very importantly people from the faith-based community who are the guys who are out there, you know, digging the drills and digging the wells in rural villages in Liberia or in Tanzania or wherever it is. And it's that kind of coordinated approach that's going to allow us to arrive at a solution. One of the happy things that has happened since our meeting and to which I think we contributed is the passage in the United States Congress of the Water for the Poor Act in November of 2005. It had strong bipartisan support. Senator Frist was very much behind it, Earl Blumenthal, others. And what it does is amend the Foreign Assistance Act of 1996 to make providing clean water and basic sanitation a focus of United States foreign policy as implemented through the Foreign Assistance Act. I think that is a huge statement. I think it's a huge statement, and particularly if we in this room and others make sure that certain that it's implemented. We know from reading any newspaper, from watching any television program that deals with this, from reading any book, that we in the United States have lost a great deal of our moral authority around the world as that we used to have. This is not the forum in which to discuss why that has happened, but it has happened. If we galvanize around an issue so as fundamental as providing clean water and basic sanitation to the people in the developing world, that's a very strong platform, and it's a platform which is embraced by everyone, everyone in this room and everyone across the board in the United States Congress. That's a very important signal. Half the people in the developing world are sick at any given time from some water-related disease. It's cholera, it's diarrhea, it's malaria, it's dengue fever. Some of its disease. The way I think of it is, suppose I had to go to my job every day sick. Suppose I were required to perform my duties sick every day. How much would I contribute to the economic development of the United States? The answer is not much, and certainly not as much as I think I do now. I hope what we have here is a perfect storm in the positive sense, and that is that people are brought to this issue from a whole variety of standpoints. What was clear when we finished our conference was that the single most important element is the political will in the developing country and the political will down the chain. Science is important. The pipes are important. There are lots of important elements. None of them work without political will. And we are now in a moment in history when the humanitarian impulse of reducing disease and saving lives is there. When people who see this, the water and sanitation issues as national security imperatives are on board, they see the political stability that comes from healthy developing environments as important to our national security. There are people who come to this issue from the standpoint of economic arguments, investment in new markets, people who have businesses in the developing world who see that worker productivity is lower than it should be, lower than it could be. You see Coca-Cola, a great user of water, but even more than a great user of water, a symbolic and visible user of water, working very aggressively in the developing world to come up with different kinds of programs to demonstrate their commitment to providing clean water and sanitation to the neighborhoods in which they work. There's a very large, represented on this stage, group of folks who see safeguarding natural resources as their clarion call to the issue, both in safeguarding wetlands and in not pumping unnecessary or unreplenishable groundwater. I think of this from a personal standpoint. My father was a chemical engineer. He saw things from the standpoint of an engineer, but he was also a fisherman and a hunter. My mother was an organic gardener. She wrote a book about it, inspired by Rachel Carson. Long ago, wrote a book on organic gardening. In spite of that background, I remember sitting around my kitchen table with my father, and his talking about the miracle of the United States and technology of being able to drain the wetlands and the Everglades, and all that unused land being reclaimed for productive purposes and for housing and for businesses. We're now spending, we in the United States, billions of dollars recreating the wetlands in the Everglades. We in the United States, in the richest history richest country in the history of the world, have the capacity to correct our mistakes. It's an expensive process. We hope not to do it. The rest of the world mostly doesn't have that capacity, and it's our job to help move that process along as we get smarter about what to do and what not to do and what we will have to undo. The thought I would leave you with until we get into the question-answer period is that this same set of issues that Rosina has introduced with respect to global climate change that feeds so importantly into these issues, the effects of global climate change, the negative effects of global climate change will clearly impact the developing world much more than they impact the developed world, certainly in the short term, and they have many fewer resources with which to anticipate and mitigate those damages. I think with the combination of The Inconvenient Truth, the film I hope you've all seen, and the discussion around these issues, that we're finally at a real turning point of people understanding and embracing the need to get busy on this. My only show and tell here is the front of Parade magazine, which last week had its cover devoted to global climate change. Parade magazine, for those of you who don't know, it has the largest circulation of any magazine on the planet. It goes to some 80 million readers across the world, and it's a very good sign indeed when Parade has decided that this is an issue worth putting on the cover. So I come here optimistic. I hope we can come to some solutions, and I thank you for the chance to talk about it a little bit.
Thank you, Hattie.
Thanks, Hattie, and thanks to Booz Allen and the Aspen Institute for having me here. The great thing about going last is I can just turn around and say I completely agree with all of you. And, instead of sort of giving you some more statistics that further drive the point home, I'll pick up where Hattie left off and work on a theme that she mentioned. Before that, I just want to mention a little anecdote because she mentioned the tsunami. So about a week after the tsunami, I actually went to Sri Lanka, and I led a team that did some of the first explorations of the coastline in a pretty remote area of the country. And we noticed many things, and we recorded all these things diligently. Last year, the one-year anniversary of the tsunami, I went back to look at what the progress had been. And one of the things that... And Sri Lanka had actually done a remarkable job in moving forward after the tsunami. I was really surprised at it. But one of the things that had just not moved at all was the fact that many, many wells along the coast, lots of coastal communities live there, were contaminated with salt water. And those wells hadn't, the flushing out didn't work. They continued to remain saline. And it was interesting because women and villagers were telling us they were now going back to old ponds that were created, 100 years ago hadn't been used, or old streams. There were paths that were cut in the forest, new paths where people were going back to get water from streams. Those villages relied on trucks that bring water in and that sort of thing. But it gave me this notion that ultimately, regardless of technological solutions, in this case, a well with a little pump there, when they fail, nature ultimately provides the sort of ultimate social security check for really poor people. Now, what I really want to talk to you a little bit about, instead of focusing on freshwater, to focus on freshwater ecosystems. It shouldn't be surprising. I work for the Nature Conservancy. It's almost what you'd expect me to say. The reason I want to focus on freshwater ecosystems is because water is finite, right? So we don't have more water today than we had 2,000 years ago. In the last 70 years, the world's population has grown from 2 billion to 6 billion. Sort of, it's gone up three times, but the water use has gone up six times. So we use water a lot more than the population growth. That's not because of drinking. It's mostly because of agriculture and industrial use of water. And because freshwater ecosystems, it turns out, provides habitat and homes for lots and lots of animals and plants and natural communities that are imperiled. So of about the 10,000 freshwater species that we've described, a good 20% of those are considered imperiled or extinct since the 1950s. That's true in the United States in the southeast, for example. It's true globally. So for those reasons, I think that when we think about freshwater and we think about this question, how do we ultimately solve this issue of making giving access to poor people fresh water, and to make water available for agriculture and other purposes. We have to think, and I don't like using this word because it's very Santa Cruzian, but we have to think holistically. That the reductionist approach tends not to work. I spent a lot of my life growing up in Africa, and I tell you, if you get off the tourist routes, and you just step off that route and you go to a village that is off the grid, off the main roads, and that's most of it, and you ask people for where the water is, they don't point you to the tap in the village. Those villages all have taps, but nearly always in the dry season, those taps run dry. And so the solution generally has been focus on pipes, focus on taps. But there are tens of thousands of taps that litter villages in Africa that don't provide water for the people. And so thinking a little bit holistically of where the water is coming from and how it regulates through the years and through the seasons in the year becomes hugely important when we think about how we want to actually provide the water to the people and wildlife that need it. So let me give you a couple of small examples of things that I think are sort of hopeful signs of how this might work or might be done. So in China, the Yangtze River, the whole damming of the Yangtze, a lot of it is because of flood control, but a huge amount of it is because of hydroelectric power. So 10% of the power of China is going to come from this one basin. And it turns out for hydroelectric power to operate efficiently, water flow needs to be there at an optimum rate. So it's no good having tons of water, and it's no good having too little water. The plants are designed to operate at a certain flow rate. It turns out deforestation mucks up that rate really badly. I'm not making the argument that, you know, I mean, with forests around, what it tends to do is it tends to decrease the peak flows and increase the troughs. And that smoothing out a little bit helps those hydroelectric plants operate more efficiently. And what China is realizing this, and they've actually put a fund together where they are, you know, charging the hydroelectric power plants, setting up some money, and that money is going towards reforestation or protection of trees in the watershed. They also have a law that basically prohibits logging since 98 of those watersheds. That law is difficult to enforce, and the incentives provided by money is probably a much, much better solution to it. The challenge is it's a very, very small amount of money given how big the problem is. The second example I will give you is a simple one, but one that I think is working quite well, and that's in the city of Quito in Ecuador. This is a fast-growing city that uses about 4.5 billion gallons of water a year. And Quito is very close to a huge reserve, a huge national park called the Condo Biosphere Reserve. It's only about 35 kilometers away from the city. And what they have done there, because the realization is that the water for the city really does come from that watershed, is that they've set up a fund. It's called FONAG, F-O-N-A-G, but it really stands for the Fund for Water. And they basically have the water utilities, the beer companies, the water companies that provide drinking water, as well as some aid agencies, and the conservation community that's interested in, you know, tourism activities in there, contribute a small amount of money, a small amount of their profits, towards a fund that goes to protecting that reserve. Right now, the amount of money they contribute is just arbitrarily set. So the hydro companies, for example, devote 1% of their profit to that. It was an arbitrary number. It's generated a $4 million fund. It's a small amount, but it's a nice start. And that money is now going to go into watershed protection. So those are signs in which I think people are starting to get this message that you can't deal with water in a reductionist manner, that if you want to provide water in Africa, just putting taps in place is just not going to do it. You have to think a little bit more holistically, and you better believe it, those taps will break down, and then you don't have the technology to fix it. So you have to think a little bit more long-term on that. The two challenges I see facing that model right now, the first one is scale. The examples we have, even the best examples we have, the Never Sink in New York, and so on and so forth, are really minuscule in scale, given the magnitude of the problem. And the second problem we have is one of valuation. And we scientists haven't done a good job, haven't done a credible job promoting and demonstrating valuation. I mean, what we really need is a function, a series of functions, that translate incremental change in nature, more trees in nature, into a resulting change in the service provided, as well as a pipe could do it, or a levee could do it, or a dam could do it, because that's the standard that we're held up to. And we can't. Our numbers are squishy and all over the place. So that's sort of the challenge that we have to face. And with water in particular, valuation becomes really challenging, as was pointed out. You know, I don't want to pick on Fiji water here, being a good sponsor here, but so I'll pick on this one, which is Voss Water, right? So this comes from Norway. It actually comes to us from Norway. Fiji Water actually comes to us from Fiji. It's 9,000 miles that this water travels to get here. We might want to sell Aspen Water in Fiji at some point. But water valuation is challenging, and that, I think, is a real, real complication that we just have to deal with.
Thank you. I'll start with a couple of questions, and not directed to anyone in particular, but I wanted to focus us first on the most impoverished areas of the world, those where people are most at risk and those where the challenge is most acute in providing the relatively small quantities of water that are required simply for drinking and for basic existence. And Sanjin, you mentioned the thousands of taps all over Africa that periodically don't work, they're dry. And I want to ask the question, where have we seen successes in this arena? And are there things, lessons learned from that, that we can capture and take to other parts of the world, other countries that are desperately in need of it? And my experience doesn't cover it, so I'm hoping you guys can identify some successes.
Well, I'll pick up on that in terms of the ecosystem services issue that Sandrine just brought up. Costa Rica has an actual working model of where it is that the downstream villages pay the upstream villages not to log, because the downstream villages understand that the logging in the upstream villages destroys their water supply. And Sanjin's point about how it is that you value this is an important one in terms of scalability, but it's not that it can't be done. And in the United States, the example is the quintessential example is the New York City water. New Yorkers are very proud of their water. EPA went to New York City and said, look, it's getting full of sediment. It's full of runoff from all these dairy farms and the Catskills from which you get your water. You've got to pay $5 billion to clean this up. And the city looked at its alternatives and went to the Catskills and paid for the cleaning up of the waste from the dairy farms and paid for planting and got ecosystem easements and so forth for the cost of $1 billion and cleaned up the water. The scaling of those kinds of things is quite difficult, and the pricing of them is quite difficult. I would answer, I very much value, I want to get back to answering Sanjin's point a little bit about the taps that have been created in Africa, which are dry part of the year. The answer to me, my answer to that is one, many of the people who put in those taps would have put them in a different place had they had the scientists, had they had the ecosystems guys to say, put them here instead of there. Mm-hmm. So there's an area for positive collaboration there. The other is that the political will that comes from people who are out there in those villages putting in those taps, it's like trying to put a value on the Peace Corps. All right, it costs how many $1,000s to send a Peace Corps volunteer to work for free in some place. Well, the value that the United States of America gets back in terms of the educated Peace Corps volunteer and in terms of the goodwill, I don't know what dollar value put on it, but it's a big one. So I'd like to work to make those pumps more effective rather than only concentrate on ecosystem and watershed management.
Well, that might be a valuable lesson learned, but Sanjin, in your travels and your living in Africa, are there success stories? Have you seen taps that don't run dry?
I really haven't. I mean, I just remember, when I was a kid in Sierra Leone, taps would provide, there was never a shortage of water. And by the time we left, 15 years later, in the cities, you'd have to store it in bathtubs and sinks and things like that. So I'm really trying hard. I think one country that is doing actually some innovative stuff with water, maybe certainly in the top tier of any country around the world, is South Africa. They have a really incredible program, this Water for Life program they do over there. Nelson Mandela himself got behind it. They employ people in watershed management, and it's an empowering sort of movement. Mm-hmm. It's one of those things that works. The other one I would say, you know, it's not direct water, but it does say how important the issue is, and that's, you know, Wangari Maathai and what she has done. You know, she basically took, she got women to go plant trees to protect two watersheds that provide 70% of the drinking water for Nairobi. And in doing that, she created a social movement that says we're going to take back our private lands. And we're not going to allow, you know, cronyism to cut the forest out. So there are these activist movements that are gaining steam. But taps still run dry. I mean, that is just a reality.
There is a success story that I think is in progress using new technologies for ultraviolet purification of contaminated water supplies, where the availability is there in terms of quantity, but the water is contaminated. This technology is very simple. It's very cheap. If people were aware of the impact that could be had on the clean water problem in many parts of the world for very modest investments, I think those investments would take off at a even greater rate than they are so far. But it's an example. There is an impression in this country in particular that development assistance is largely wasted, that it ends up in the Swiss bank accounts of corrupt politicians and so on and so forth. And there, of course, there is corruption. But there are avenues by which amounts of money that are modest in the context of the industrialized nations' budgets for practically everything else could have an immense impact on this problem with technologies that are available today. The United States today is spending under 0.2% of GNP on development assistance. We spend more on Botox treatments, I think, today than on assistance. And a little better communication about what could be done with modest sums of money, mm-hmm. I think, would contribute a lot to solving this problem.
I just want to get us away from the single well to the pipes,
right?
Because the classic saying is God gave us water, but he didn't give us the pipes. And the pipes issue is very much affected by this issue of corruption or not. One of the clear things in all of this is the element of rule of law, and that is the issue of corruption. And where does the money go? How does the management work? And one of the lessons I think that we have learned and had to relearn over and over again is that this issue of pipes and governance goes hand in hand. If you need to fix the governance to fix the pipes, you could also, at one level, fix the governance by fixing the pipes. That is, if you decentralize the decision-making with respect to the use of water, something Mexico's doing right now. They've got 1,000 steps to go, and they've only taken their first one. But you get the decision-making in the hands of the villages or in the hands of the watershed managers or in the hands of the people who are managing the river flows, so that the decisions are made there and not in the capitals, and you have a chance of connecting up the governance with the pipes in a much more useful way.
Hattie, you mentioned Coca-Cola and some of the things that they were doing. And Sanjan, you mentioned the businesses in Quito that are collaborating to protect the nearby water basin. Are there things that leaders of businesses or major corporations or multinational corporations should be doing that they're not today, or things that they should be thinking about to help alleviate the water scarcity problem around the world?
This morning I was at this panel with GE and others talking about technology and the investment in the environment. This is a small use of water. I understand that, but it's a big industry. It's about $50 billion worth, right, per year. And you get an industry that big, and I don't understand the pricing on it, and I'm sure someone here does, but I don't really understand why you can sell this for $10 a gallon and another water would go for $8 a gallon. I'm not sure that people wouldn't pay $12. I mean, it didn't stop me from buying it when I walked into a store. So that's an industry that can do a lot more, and there are groups within that industry who are moving in this direction. but just both from corporate, you know, sort of giving back some percentage of their profit, because I don't think it'll hurt. I don't think it'll hurt the marketplace. If they if that water bottle is 10 cents more, it's not going to stop anyone from going out and buying it. The second thing is the bottling industry, so like the beer industry, Saab Miller, for example, so they use about 3 to 5 times, you know, pints of water for every pint of beer produced. So they're acutely aware of the importance of making sure that there's good water protection. And I think they've shown some leadership in protecting water sources.
There's also been a lot of corporate leadership in the climate change area, which, as we've seen, is intimately connected to these water problems. GE, DuPont, 3M, Exelon, Synergy, a lot of the biggest energy companies in this country have embraced the reality of the climate change challenge, have changed their corporate practices and their business plans to address it, and have actually been increasingly energetically lobbying the federal government for a national policy, which is sort of the reverse of what one usually expects in this sort of domain. The big corporations calling on the federal government for a national policy to reduce greenhouse gas emissions because they want certainty, they want predictability, they want a level playing field, and they recognize that this is an opportunity as well as a challenge, a way in which the businesses that figure out first how to deliver the goods and services that people want in energy-saving and climate-sparing ways will actually make a lot of money at it. That's what's behind GE's Eco Imagination program. They say, we're going to build and market the technologies that are going to address this problem. We're going to make money at it. I think we're seeing a lot of corporate leadership in that domain. It's not universal. There are some companies that are on the other side of that spectrum. But I think it's a very promising domain.
Why don't we take questions from you folks? Anybody got some questions? You want to go to the microphone so we can hear you?
My name is Chrissy Logier, and because water is life, my question is, isn't population control a huge underlying component to this issue? And is this part of your conversation in your forums and conferences? I just haven't heard anything about that. Is it part of the conversation?
I would say it's certainly part of the conversation. When we talk about climate change, when we talk about water availability, it is clear that the requirements for resources and the impacts on the environment are the product of 3 or 4 factors, depending on how you do the arithmetic. One is population. A second is affluence reflected in the amount of consumption per person, either of natural resources or of environmental goods and services. And a third is the technology that translates that consumption into specific demands. And if ultimately you want to solve these problems, you need to look at all three factors. It would be a lot easier to address the world's water problems, the world's energy problems, and the climate change challenge if there were only going to be 8 billion people in the world in 2100 rather than 10 billion or 12 billion. And the good news about population is that we have learned that the greatest leverage on population growth is the education and health care and access to reproductive services and other opportunities for women around the world. As you improve the status of women and their access to everything that matters, starting with education, population growth rates go down. We ought to continue with the efforts in that direction because it's worth doing for its own sake, and it makes all these problems we're talking about easier to solve.
A touchy conversation that I think needs to be paramount.
I have just one thought to add there, and that is that Population Action International does very good work dealing with the issue of population as a driver for these issues. And the Water for the Poor Act that I talked about a little bit about earlier focuses very much on the role of women in the delivery and benefit of from clean water and good sanitation, partly because of the reason that John discussed, which is that from a population standpoint, the issue is clearly linked to the
development and economic development and education of women, and partly because in developing countries, the role of collecting water. All those photographs that you see of African women walking 6 kilometers to get a thing of water to carry back to their hut on their head, the reason you see so many of them is not just because it's an interesting photograph, it's because that defines the life of many of the women on the planet. And to the extent that they are better educated and can spend their time in a different way, it decreases pressures on water and increases their capacity to contribute.
Question?
Yes, thank you. My name is Chelsea Congdon. I'm interested in the policy issue. Hattie, I appreciate the examples that you gave of progress with respect to water policy, and water for people, water for poor people. But John Holdren and others you've all made the argument that there's need for more policy and leadership in this area. Part of that is a function of getting the word out and getting people, populations, understanding that they need to learn more and the media presenting more. But it also seems like there's a moral or an ethical part of the argument that can help bring this home to a public audience. And I'm wondering if you can speak to the role of churches or people of faith who might be involved in issues of freshwater access or freshwater ecosystems.
We had a number of participants from the faith-based community in the event I had, as I mentioned, and the folks from Living Water, Jerry Wiles and Malcolm, forgotten Malcolm's last name. Anyway, they were a very important part of the discussion. And they were a very important part of the discussion because they speak to a different audience than we do, and they are able to mobilize a different audience than the integrated watershed management folks can do. I think it's a key to getting the right amount of attention to the issue. One of the things we've talked about before in kind of deciding how we would approach this is the issue of water in general and potable drinking water. And they're two very different issues. I mean, John said three times, and maybe everybody else here has said three times as well, the vast percentage of water is used for agricultural use. It's irrigation in the developed world and the developing world. Getting potable water to the people who lack it is a solvable problem. It is, it is something we can do with the political will to do it. And shame on us if we don't. It is a moral imperative, and we can do it.
You know, Hattie mentioned that we were perhaps reaching a perfect storm in a good sense to act on these issues. And in the same way that John mentioned, corporations are stepping up to the plate to call for change, call for political activity on climate change, call for mandatory emission reductions. The religious community has become very active in the last couple of years in speaking out on how climate change is a moral issue. And, of course, the most recent being the statement by the evangelicals with a call for immediate reductions. I think every major religion in the world has actually put out a statement on the issue of climate change being a moral challenge. So it's not water per se, but again, you can't go very far down the path of thinking about climate change and how, of course, as you said, the poor will be the most disadvantaged without running into the issue of water.
Next question.
Yes, thank you. I'm Sheldon Lubar from Wisconsin. And I'd like to address this to you, Professor Birnbaum. In view of everything that's been said about water, climate change, and so forth, what is the impact of this on the Great Lakes, perhaps the greatest store of fresh water in the world?
Right, 20% of the world's fresh water. Paradoxically, although the world will be getting wetter, the Great Lakes will probably be decreasing in their volume, and that is in part because of the reduction in ice cover during the winter. So, in fact, evaporation can continue all winter long. So 9 of the 11 global models project that the Great Lakes will actually drop several feet over the longer term. And the water managers are beginning to take a hard look at this because, in fact, it looks like these levels will be outside of the levels we have historically managed for, in particular in Lake Ontario, which is the first one they've been studying. So it does open these issues of the 100 years preceding are not really a good prequel to what we expect in the future. And so we're going to probably have to think about dealing with lower lake levels and figure out what that means for the Great Lakes ecosystems and the surrounding area. So we do expect lower levels.
Water quality, what will happen?
Well, water quality issues, I mean, I showed you the concentration of the combined sewer overflows are in the Midwest. And as we are getting wetter, and I don't know if you noticed, but Wisconsin and Michigan have gotten some 20% wetter over the last 100 years, we are having more of these flash flooding events, which do combine the sewerage and the surface runoff and potentially lead to health effects. But then the change in timing and delivery of precipitation, so sometimes you get more of it. There are times when there's droughts. The pollutants that get washed from the tributaries into the Great Lakes may get more or less concentrated depending on whether it's a drought or a flood. And so, for example, the Midwest contribution to the huge hypoxic zone in the Gulf of Mexico, even if we reduced, say, nitrogen fertilizer by 30%, which should help the hypoxic zone a great deal, as we expect the runoff to change, it may completely negate that. So we may actually be washing more of the fertilizer effect into the zone. So there's a lot of devil in these details of generally wetter, but sometimes drier, how pollutants interreact, whether invasives are going to do better in warmer temperatures, how the fish populations in the Great Lakes may change as they warm, how the Great Lakes get stratified more, they themselves may become more anoxic. All these details are just beginning to be teased out experimentally, and we really don't know how the combination of impacts will play out. And to me, that's one of the biggest worries, that we're not in a systematic way studying the interaction of all of these multiple stresses and climate change together, invasives, pollution, habitat fragmentation, runoff, and climate change. Because as we saw with the Everglades, we might make matters worse. And when I showed you Florida, I showed a third of the Everglades underwater. So that $8 billion to replumb the Everglades is likely to disappear as sea level rises. So I really think we need to begin to think about these things as a combined whole, so that any solution set we choose doesn't exacerbate another problem and actually builds in some resiliency to climate change.
Next question.
Greg Bangs from New Jersey. I was struck by Dr. Holdren's presentation at the low number regarding desalinization. Without going into a whole number lesson, could you give us a little idea of where you think desalinization can best be applied and also go over the problems as to what is perhaps keeping it from being more used?
Well, the widest uses of desalination today are for drinking and municipal water in parts of the world where it's scarce. And so one of the biggest desalters is Saudi Arabia. Not surprisingly, Kuwait is not far behind. Southern California is moving into desalting in a larger way. One can easily afford the cost of desalted water for drinking water and for other municipal uses in affluent societies. But it is just plain too costly to be used to address the larger volume needs. And it is likely to remain so. One of the reasons it's likely to remain too costly is that in a modern large thermal desalination plant, 60% of the cost of the desalted water is energy cost. And energy is not getting cheaper, you may have noticed. And it's not likely to get a lot cheaper anytime soon, if ever. And that means that the prospects for making desalted water much cheaper just aren't very good. So it is limited to uses where you can pay quite a lot for water, not bottled water kinds of numbers, but the very high end of what municipalities are used to paying for water. Again, in California today, people pay 50 cents for 1,000 liters of tap water. If you want to get that from desalted water in California today, you're going to have to pay closer to $1.50. That's a tripling of what people are paying. Now, again, Californians are, for the most part, prosperous enough not to notice that impact nearly as much as they notice $3 a gallon gasoline. But it does mean that the uses of desalted water are not going to expand into the high-volume applications.
John, if I may, there's also in one of the stumbling blocks on these plants is just not in my backyard mentality, because there's a big plan for a plant in Southern California right now that is stuck. You know, they're going to put them on the ocean side. That's where people want to live, and they don't want a big thermal plant there.
Now, we used to talk about NIMBY, the not in my backyard phenomenon. As one looks at resource projects and energy projects of a wide variety of kinds, the new acronym is becoming BANANA, build absolutely nothing anywhere near anybody.
Next question.
No one's mentioned the issue. The reason Saudi Arabia and Kuwait are big producers of desalted water is because they have abundant energy, pouring CO2 into the atmosphere to create water.
Next question.
My name is Phil Rothblum. Could you discuss what efforts are being made to diminish the demand and consumption of fresh water in agricultural purposes, especially in water-starved areas such as the Middle East?
Who wants to address that question?
Well, I can take a shot at it. There have been, over the last few decades, actually, a lot of advances in reducing the amount of water used in agriculture, drip irrigation, and things of this sort. And that's one of the reasons that in the United States, the water use has leveled off over the past few decades, notwithstanding continuing expansion of population, economic activity, and agriculture. There's a tremendous potential there. I'd be a lot more worried myself about the fact that humans today are withdrawing 5,000 cubic kilometers out of 12,000 available in freshwater flows if it were not for the immense potential of expanding these advances in the efficiency of water use in agriculture. But another thing that's going to do it besides technology is price. You come back to this point. In California, 85% of the water is used for agriculture, and a very substantial proportion of that is used for growing rice and alfalfa in terrain that would never be considered for rice and alfalfa if you had to pay the actual cost of getting the water there. It has been pointed out that in California, 50% of the water is used to generate something like half a percent of the GDP of the state of California, because the crops that are being grown with these immense water inputs are low-value crops. Hmm. And we wouldn't do that anymore if the water was actually priced as a commodity.
Well, the number one use of electricity in California, and this shocked me, is water. It's moving water from Northern California to Southern California. It beats any other industry in California. I couldn't believe it. I had to go check it again. WRI's website has it. It's astounding. And what they grow becomes hugely important.
And having come to this as the optimist, this is an area where I'm less optimistic. It's the subsidies given to grow the wrong things in the wrong places are so difficult to back away from politically that it's a very, very tough process. Talking about a different kind of subsidy, but maybe there's some ideas here. We have huge agricultural subsidies, not for water, but simply for growing or not growing crops in the Middle West. One of the ideas, an inventive idea of someone to whom I'm related, is to say, look, we're not going to get rid of the subsidy, the agricultural subsidies in the Midwest, but don't pay farmers to grow crops that shouldn't be growing there or to not grow crops that shouldn't be growing there. Pay them the subsidies to reforest the land, to reprotect the stream beds, to reprotect the ecosystems, to put in those things which were taken out at a point in our history when we thought we wanted to have entire states covered with corn. And so I think what we need to do about the repricing is to think about them in a very political policy way, about not just how do we reduce the subsidies that causes these odd things to happen that Sandrine just talked about, but how do we reconfigure them in a way that's real.
Well, I was also thinking about the use of effluents or wastewater to use for agricultural purposes.
You have to be a little careful with that because it depends on what the effluent contains as to whether it's safe to put it on crops, which have the capacity to take up some of the nasties, particularly trace metals, for example. So you sometimes have to do some processing of that effluent before you can use it for agriculture, but certainly we could do a much better job of managing water overall and matching the quality to the application in a better way than we do so far. And it's very similar in a number of ways to the energy situation, where over the last 30 years we have learned a lot about using energy more efficiently and matching energy sources better to the applications. We have a long way to go still in that domain, but we could learn quite a lot.
Am I looking at investing in a set of policies that are looking at land use change? Am I looking at technologies? I have this whole panoply of possibilities, and yet we're talking about this as an integrated issue. As a scientist, I'm also interested in, John and Rosina in particular, how would you convince me that I should look at science and technology as really part of this problem when I actually see it as a delivery problem, as a healthcare issue, as a non-science issue? How am I going to look at the integrated issues over the future so that 2015 isn't the deadline? I'm looking at the influence of climate change and other things beyond that deadline, and how do I look at this in an integrated way and then make investments today to get at that integration?
I think all of these problems are all of the above when it comes to, is it a technological problem, an economic problem, a political problem, a cultural problem,
yes,
a psychological problem? They're all of the above. That's true of water. It's true of climate. It's true of energy. And what I would say to you, Sherry, if you had the $1 billion at the Gates Foundation, is the first thing you need to do is you need to make a map of the terrain of who is doing what with what kinds of resources to address which aspects of this problem and their interaction, and look for the big gaps, look for the conspicuous gaps. That's what the MacArthur Foundation did 25 years ago when it decided that there was an infusion of money needed into the area of how we think about nuclear weapons and national security. It realized it was a technical problem, an economic problem, a political problem, and that you couldn't put the money into any one thing and have it make sense. You had to survey the terrain and then put the money where it was likely to do some good. I suspect if you did that terrain analysis that you'd put a good part of the Gates $1 billion into propagating these marvelously efficient UV purifiers of water in a great many parts of the world where sanitary water is not available. But in the course of trying to do that, you would have to figure out not just, you know, what the best of these technologies is, but you have to figure out what the mechanism is by which you're going to propagate them into communities and the mechanism by which people in the communities are going to learn to operate them and maintain them over time.
Any other thoughts on that question?
Only one, and that is one of the very specific suggestions that our group came up with, which I was a little suspicious of initially, was to focus on putting clean water and basic sanitation in schools across the developing world. And the notion was it gives you something concrete to do. It forces you to, it will deal with the issue of girls and women because it will enable girls and women to go to school. Girls stop going to schools in places where they have schools to go to when they reach puberty because there's no area for basic sanitation. It starts a virtuous circle. Having been initially skeptical of that as sounding a little too do-gooder and a little too unconnected to the larger issues, but I'm sorry, I'm now convinced that that's a very useful place from which to begin.
Final question.
Yes, good morning. My name is Neil Wilkie. I'd like to get back to political will, if I may, for a moment. For years, I've been working very closely with various Chesapeake Bay organizations. I was interested in the Great Lakes comment. And I served on a commission last year. It turned out we needed about $9 billion to clean the Chesapeake Bay. We're not going to get it from corporations, not from GE, or from fantastic foundations like the Chesapeake Bay Foundation or the Nature Conservancy, maybe a little. So I went and talked to one of my friends who had been a co-chairman of the Pew Oceans Commission, and I said, well, look, we're a microcosm. We're just the Chesapeake Bay. You have the whole oceans. What's your read on it? And the answer was, at least in Washington, it's like hitting your head against a stone wall. There is no political will. And we thought perhaps maybe Katrina would help. There was some thinking that it took a catastrophe to wake up our members of Congress that these things were really important. It has not really helped. You guys are wonderful to do your work on your basis, but what can we do to try to increase the political will in Washington to take care of our water problems in this country? Thank you.
Well, I worked for the Congress for 13 years, and I could never get into a member's office as easily as you can get in to a member that you are the constituent of. And they do read those letters, and they answer those letters, and they do keep track of what issues are polling well and what issues their offices are being assaulted about. So it does sound trite, but it actually is one of the most powerful things every citizen can do, which is to communicate with their members in the Congress as well as their state legislators. You know, I think you also need to have scientists be out there being public civic scientists, talking to Rotary clubs and educating other people so that they're writing their members of Congress as well. And I mean, we have seen in cases like the Everglades where the $8 billion appeared. We're not sure it's all completely well-founded now that we look at some of the complications. But there have been tipping points in issues before, and I think in the issue of climate change, we're actually reaching one. The oceans are, as those two reports that came out back-to-back, in terrible straits. The health of the entire ocean as well as the fisheries are very problematic. So I would never underestimate the power of communications with your legislators making a difference and vote those issues and make those issues part of the elections.
You also have to keep your eye on the big picture, though, and this may be an unduly political statement for the Aspen Ideas Festival, but when you have a funding squeeze in the government between the costs of the Iraq War and the hurricane recovery on the one hand, and the extension of tax cuts, the great bulk of which goes to the most prosperous percent or two of the population, there is no discretionary money left for anything. And when you go to the Congress, no matter how many letters you write, if you need $9 billion to clean up the Chesapeake Bay, you're not going to get it in a government fiscal environment where the finances of the nation are being mismanaged in this particular way. You've got to keep your eye on the big picture.
Would anyone like the last
Not
word?
After that.
Other than John?
Last word.
Okay, well, look, I want to thank the audience, and I want to thank our panel for this morning's discussion.